I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. I am Jack Pelling, and with me as always is...
It's Mr. Robin Allender here.
Hey man, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. Yes, how are you?
I'm not too bad. We're sort of pre-recording these links because I'm about to go on holiday in about half an hour. So if they're a bit rushed, I'm very sorry.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Sicily.
Don't be so silly.
Oh, thanks. Good one, Dad.
Yeah, I love Sicily. It's brilliant. Make sure you have a lovely ice cream. Have you ever seen... have you ever watched Chef's Table?
I've seen a couple of them.
There's a really good one about a Sicilian... gelato maker.
Oh, nice.
Brilliant.
Okay, maybe I'll watch that on the plane. So this week we're chatting to a fantastic guest, Christian Madden, who is an incredible keyboard player and plays in the touring band and has recorded records with Liam Gallagher, as well as some other people, including Daniel Johnston. And you played in bands with him as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so I joined a band called The Revival Hour about 8 years ago and did a couple of tours with them. Revival Hour was formed out of John Mark Clapham and Christian Madden, who played in the earlies, who were around the sort of mid-noughties. Mm-hmm.
They were a brilliant band. Transatlantic band, weren't they?
Yeah, American singer, and they were all based in but they were all based in Manchester, kind of big band on stage. It was great. They were a really cool band, kind of just a range of influences, quite beta bandy, I guess. Yeah, cool. I met Christian through the Revival Hour, and yeah, he's an incredible musician. And we've got some mutual friends as well, like... Because he's from Burnley, the first time I met him, I was like, oh, do you know Tom Wilson and Sean Canty? And he was like, yeah, I went to school with them. I don't know if that's a Burnley thing.
Yeah, and we do hear some music that he's played with a couple of Burnley pals. In lockdown, they did a really cool cover of Eleanor Rigby, which we'll play a little snippet of.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, and he also is a massive Beatles fan, so we talked to him a lot about his sort of formative Beatles memories. Specifically, we talked quite a bit about Billy Preston and Nicky Hopkins and their work sort of playing keys for the Beatles. And he also talks quite a lot about his touring days with Liam Gallagher and what it's like to record at Abbey Road on some of those old cool instruments with Liam's singing voice, Lennon's influence on Liam, which is massive. And he talks a bit about playing with Daniel Johnston too, which was really interesting, who's also a massive Beatles fan.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, of course, yeah. So that was lovely. That was a lovely story.
So there's loads of great stuff to look forward to. But before we start that, is there any other stuff on the agenda today?
Well, I just want to give a shout out to a man I met in Forest Hill, London, yesterday, who just stopped me in the street to say he was really enjoying the podcast.
Fantastic. It was
one of the weirdest things that's ever happened. So thanks, Toby. He asked me if I had a recommendation for a Beatles book to get into the Beatles. So I, of course, recommended Revolution in the Head.
Yeah, great choice.
Which is a kind of go-to. But that was great and quite surreal.
Fantastic. Oh, well, thank you for listening, Toby. We're recording a bit early this week, so we don't have much in the way of correspondence, but we did get something that dropped into our inbox in the early hours of this morning, and it says, for the attention of Robin Allender. So this is intriguing.
It's not a court summons.
It says... Hi, Robin, long-time listener, first-time emailer. For fear of repercussions, I would ask that you respect my anonymity. So far, so ominous. I am one of Jack's oldest and most handsome friends. Okay, I think from the off that we know that he's either drunk or an imposter because I don't have any handsome friends. But unfortunately for Jack, the longevity of our friendship is an Achilles heel, especially given my exceptional memory and Jack's weak bladder, which is unfortunately true, but I don't know what it's got to do with anything. But he says, I was slightly taken aback by Jack's strong views on people who are critical of Ringo Starr's drumming. From 2011 to 2018, Jack would regularly use the phrase, he is the Ringo of the Beatles, using it as shorthand for being lucky or at least or the least talented member of a group. After the umpteenth time Jack had used this phrase, I recall with exceptional, if not borderline, photographic memory, querying Jack about the overused statement, to which Jack stated, "Well, Ringo was lucky to be in the Beatles. He is not the greatest drummer in the world." We'll come on to this at the end. So you can imagine the horror of Jack's hypocrisy in last week's episode and the vilification of who...
But of can I just press pause a second? You don't know this person?
I've got a pretty good idea who it is, yeah.
Oh, right, but it's anonymous. Okay.
So he says, "I make this intervention with a heavy heart, but feel it's in the public interest to call out such double standards and the only way to ensure the integrity of the podcast. Yours faithfully, Jack's delusional and drunk friend." I mean, I put that bit in. To be honest, yeah, I do know who this person is. And
right,
considering most of my conversations about the Beatles usually take place between the hours of sort of 11 and p.m. and 3 a.m., there is definitely a lot of things that... And it might be something that I had to say, but also I feel like I need to issue a pretty strong and frank rebuttal to these slanderous allegations. I've never said that Ringo is the best drummer in the world. And anyone who's in the Beatles is lucky to be in the Beatles because it's the Beatles. But maybe technically he's not a John Bonham or a Barrymore Barlow.
Well, it wouldn't have worked with that, would it?
And what he does, you know, Ringo's brilliance and his influence comes from a lot more than the technical aspects of his drumming. You know, it's the way that he drums complements songs in such a brilliant way. He's such a key part of the songwriting process.
Yeah, and the great thing about Ringo's drumming as well is, particularly in the early stuff, in those rock and roll songs, there's a slight swing to the way he plays, which is really, really distinctive and brilliant.
Yeah, and the way that he sort of, the relationship between his drumming and Paul McCartney's bass playing is the, you know, the rock and the foundation. And we've said it before, but if you listen to the difference between the Beatles playing with their earlier drummers and and what happened when Ringo walked into the room, and they all talk about it, you know, as this sort of magic light bulb moment. So
yeah, speaking of that though, like, I mean, if you're gonna pick oneself up on controversial musical opinions, one said, my friend Phil started listening to the podcast and he said he remembered in our first year at university, I said I didn't like the Beatles because they were too popular. and I also said that Craig David would be seen as this generation's Marvin Gaye. One out of two ain't bad. So there you go.
Perfect. Well, I mean, I'm not going to sort of defend. I mean, to be fair, I did. You know, this is obviously the mad ramblings of a man entering the second week of quarantine with two children under three.
Right.
If it is you. But to be fair, I did actually edit out a section of last week's show that where I sort of... I listened back to it and I realised that my anecdote about the circumstances of getting into DJ Shadow was completely false memory, and actually was the other way around. So I actually took that bit out because I knew this person would write in.
Oh, really?
But they'd written in anyway.
Christ.
That's funny. There we go.
I've had a few messages and things on the social meds. People saying, we should do an episode where we talk about covers of Beatles songs.
Yeah.
Which would be quite interesting. And, you know, I was thinking about Breeders cover of Happiness is a Warm Gun, Susie and the Banshees covering Dear Prudence. We should talk about some of those. Did you see Idols covering Helter Skelter?
I did, yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Yeah.
Someone was posting about that the other day, and another couple of Idols covers that they did this week. And like coming on from the John Ronson episode, there's been quite a lot of Twitter discussion about the Fiona Apple version of Across the Universe and the Bowie version. I really like the Fiona Apple version, actually. I don't think I'd heard it that much before.
And speaking of covers, but of a slightly different meaning, I had another message asking us about our favourite album covers. This is my friend Drew. Drew's the one who, I think, says he doesn't like any Beatles song recorded after Revolver. Completely insane. But his favourite album cover is Revolver, which is a classic. But what's your favourite album cover?
I mean, this is all kind of tied into the lockdown puzzle extravaganza. So, I mean, my favourite cover is Sgt. Pepper. I mean, I remember as a
kid. Can I just shock you?
Yeah.
With the Beatles.
Well, what, the one of them just in a line?
Yeah, but Ringo's underneath.
Yeah. Okay.
It's something so It's a very iconic image, and it's weirdly unbalanced because that one head's lower.
I mean, that's almost a controversial Beatles opinion.
Yeah, but fine.
Great. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's no puzzle of that.
No.
But yeah, I mean, the Peter Blake cover of Sgt. Pepper is, there's so much to look at, and I love everything about the way the record was packaged, and because it was the first sort of vinyl that I ever listened to, I love the card inlays and the little key telling you who all the little people were and stuff, and also, I mean, there's no album that looks anything like that before it. You know, it was all part and parcel of them kind of inventing the idea of the LP as they went along. So, yeah, that would have to be my answer, really.
Fair enough. That's a good answer.
Yeah. Right, on with the show. Here's Christian Madden. We'll be back at the end with a little bit of Gubbins. But just to do the general sort of housekeeping, if you have any correspondence and you want to share any stories or any personal Beatles memories from your, you know, formative Beatles years, you can get in touch at personalbeatles.com/contact. You can follow us on social media at Personal Beatles on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. And if you want to help us out supporting the show, then you can contribute to some of the overheads by going to personalbeatles.com/donate. And thank you so much for everyone who has done that over the last month. It's really, really appreciated, and it does, you know, really help and give us the opportunity to sort of keep on going. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So here is Christian Madden. How are you doing, Christian? Thank you so much for agreeing to join us.
My pleasure. Anything to fill the days.
Yeah, how has your lockdown been in general? I know you've had quite a lot of gigs cancelled and stuff.
A lot of gigs cancelled. I'm not, you know, living quite healthy. Eating a lot less, drinking a lot less, going for walks along the River Ribble, homeschooling.
Lovely. Are you playing more or less music, do you reckon?
I practice every day. So it's good in that way, actually. Being on tour sometimes means you only get near your instrument for half an hour every 3 days or something. So, you know, I do something every day. And then I've been doing loads of these lockdown video jams where you send somebody, you know, something off your phone with you playing keyboards on, and everyone's doing it, so it's not interesting.
No, that's good. I find I'm drinking more in lockdown, to be honest.
Yeah, well, it depends. It depends whether you're homeschooling your children or not, because if you do that drunk, you're called a bad parent.
Well, I've started tutoring online to kind of make
pissed. On this? Just quick check.
Yeah. But I find myself like going, oh God, I've had two lessons today, and then just cracking open a can as if I've had a really hard day's work.
What's your can of choice on this?
Oh, Stella's 440 mil.
Stella, 90s. Yeah. 90s style.
Yeah, sorry. Great. About you, but you're not really a big drinker at home, are you?
I can't get pissed. Well, I can. I'm going to say I can't get pissed in houses, but I must be able to.
It's not a specialist skill.
No. Yeah. I'll say it doesn't feel like that it's doing out to me when I'm in an house, but
right.
But it must do.
Yeah, it's got to be doing it on some level.
Yeah.
Sorry, Jack, I interrupted your segue there with the,
No, not at all. I was just going to ask you about, because you've been doing those YouTube things, and that was quite a neat little segue into a version of Eleanor Rigby that you did.
Oh, yeah. I played that with a bunch. The other three lads who I did that with used to do a Beatles. In fact, they've done loads of Beatles tributes between them.
Cool. Who was that then?
They're all Burnley lads. There was one, Chris Lewis, who's been Ringo in many a lineup. Danny Handley has been Paul, John and George. He was playing guitar on it. And then Scott Whitley. Yeah, he used to run the Cheatles.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, good. Yeah. But there were only three of them, so they were cheating.
Yeah.
But they were very, very good. The harmonies were brilliant. So.
That's cool. So what did you find playing Eleanor Rigby? Like, is there anything you like notice and love about the chords or anything like that, you know, on a technical level?
It's simpler than you think when you're listening to that string arrangement, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard loads of versions of it, but it still stands up, doesn't it? It stands up when you pull all that string arrangement out of it, which is really a testament to its quality, really. It's a good enough melody on its own, isn't it? All the lonely people, they do, they all belong.
that arrangement when you're all in separate houses on different sides?
Well, I came on last, so.
Right. So you fill in the jingly bits.
Yeah, yeah. So I think Danny actually just put down something. The singer who was playing guitar put down something strong enough that sort of everybody else just picked up off that, really, you know. And then he sent me a message saying to double him up at some point and take a little bit of a lead line here and there. So
nice. Well, it's a wicked version. If people want to hear it, they can go to youtube.com and just search for Christian and Ellen Rigby. Yeah. It's a great site. There's a lot of stuff on there.
Yeah, yeah. Some terrible stuff on there.
Yeah. So what do you remember what the first Beatles song you ever learnt to play on the keyboard was?
To play? I know the first, solo one would be Imagine, because that's obviously, you know, not too hard on the piano. I don't remember learning an awful lot of them. I did have a Beatles keyboard book when I was about 13 or 14 where it was hold a chord in your left hand with the auto rhythm on.
Yes, I had that
and
too.
And play the melody.
Yeah.
So I learned, like, I remember playing Here, There and Everywhere.
Wow, yeah.
Anything you play by McCartney, actually, because they're all, you know, Lennon's melodies tend to be a little bit focused around one note or two notes.
Yeah, they're very. There's a lot of kind of like da da here.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of that. It's not like Julia's just basically one note, and whereas McCartney, it tends to swoop up and down the octave. So they're great to play on any instrument, aren't they? As are his bass lines. So I remember going through a few of them, and then when I started actually learning the keyboard parts of things, Imagine would have been an early one of those, and Jealous Guy actually.
Yeah, that's a good one to play.
And then when I was about 19, I was in Denny Lane's band out of Wings, and then I had to learn loads of McCartney's solo ones. So I did actually do a lot of the solo career stuff as well.
Cool. Did Denny Lane ever play Penny Lane? I mean, I'm sure I'm not the first.
He didn't, but he used to murder Blackbird. he did a terrible version of that.
Right.
Every night.
Crikey.
If he's listening, it was shit. I doubt he is.
So they were they performing as Wings after Wings finished? Like doing old Wings?
I mean, Linda.
Only the band that Wings could have been.
Yeah.
Well, there's an agent around here, a ruthless agent in Clitheroe called Pete Barton, who I think did put Wings on all the posters. But he said, well, as far as I know, Band on the Run was Paul McCartney and Wings. And Linda's died. And it's Paul McCartney and Wings. And Denny Lane's the only other person on the album. So he is Wings. So, like, just, you know, this logic allowed him to sell it as whatever he wanted. But I had to learn, like, a lot of McCartney keyboard parts in that. And there's always these octaves rolling all the way through in the left-hand part, and that sort of unlocks the playing style for you. So if you're doing something like Lady Madonna, it sounds more complicated than it is.
Is that right? Because we were talking
about
this.
Martha Idea as well.
Yeah, I was going to say that one. We were talking about this idea of how proficient the Beatles got so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, to me, McCartney's playing on Lady Madonna and Martha, My Dear sounds incredibly technical, but it's probably actually not, isn't it? I'm just hearing it as a guitarist.
It's very good. But it's clever. That left-hand part's just going all the way through. It's just octaves like a bass player would play on a disco record.
Yeah, exactly.
But the way the right hand sort of has the spacing and rests in it, and the left hand then pokes through, and it makes it sound more complicated and sort of contrapuntal than it is, because for your head to play it, it's really easy, you know. So.
What does a contrapuntal mean? Sorry.
two separate melodies.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Right. That's nice. I might use that, because I'm teaching guitar at the moment, and I'm kind of like using these. I'm kind of like sometimes, like, you know, explaining something and having to Google it at the same time.
Well, that's all right. So long as you've got, you know, a good game face for when you're actually reading a Wikipedia entry, but trying to maintain eye contact with a student, you can get away with it.
So so when you learned to play those songs, so did you already have the knowledge of the Beatles then? So what's your kind of first memory of listening to them?
I was just thinking, when you told me to think about this podcast beforehand, I was like, was trying to remember my introduction to them, and I sort of concluded that I think I knew the Beatles before I even knew what music was or cared what it was. Because I remember that moment when you start really being into music and recording the charts on a Sunday night, and that, like, it was Madonna that did that for me. So when I heard Into the Groove, then I, you know, then I was interested in all music from that point on, but I would have already been a Beatles fan before that. So we had that.
So was it, was that just kind of from osmosis, like your parents?
Yeah, but they didn't even have loads of it around the house. They used to have that rock and roll compilation.
My parents.
Where there's a sort of drawing of them on the front, laughing in Beatle gear. And then when I was about six or so, I think I bought my dad Sergeant Pepper for his Christmas present. My mum suggested to me that would be a good Christmas present for him, and we got it. I mean, I was confused because that sounds like another band's name. It's like, no, it isn't.
Right.
And they're dressed up as this band.
Marketing.
And then
nightmare.
That's completely different from these rock and roll mop top ones. And then when I was at junior school, I remember me and Sean Canty used to play The Beatles. That was our game at dinner time. And we'd pretend to be The Beatles. And like, we'd pretend to get shot. Like, like you'd play Transformers, you know, and one of you'd be Optimus Prime. And so we're playing The Beatles. Who are you? I'm John. Watch out, John. You know, that kind of game. We had no idea about the circumstances of his death other than, you know, he got shot. And that was part of our dinner time game.
Wow. I saw Sean Canty the other day in the, because he was, Jack, if you don't know, he plays in a band called Demdike Stare. And he played at Cafe Oto just before lockdown, I think. So I saw him then, and it was very good and very engrossing. But it's, I wouldn't put, having known Sean for a while, I do have this weird dissonance of the type of music it is, which is very like wire reader kind of esoteric droney stuff, you know.
He was definitely, you know, he started out a Beatles fan like everybody, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Canty used to come round to my house when we were about 13. I mean, so that was the second wave of Beatle discovery, you know. And then we used to just, there'd be about four of us sat in my bedroom and we'd just listen to Sergeant Pepper all the way through on vinyl, and nobody was allowed to speak. So we did that a couple of times a week when we were 13 or 14, which, I mean, at the time as well, now, like, everybody's into everything all the time because of how streaming platforms and playlists and all that work. But you know, if you were listening to the Beatles version of Strawberry Fields instead of Candy Flip when we were teenage, then you were just an idiot, you know. Just a Luddite pillock. So
But there was that kind of thing where, like, say, like a band like the Stone Roses, like their kind of Beatlesiness came about because, like, a lot of the albums were kind of pressed on, you know, were available on CD for the first time around the time. So, like, the idea that it wasn't always just readily available at the click of the button is kind of quite important, isn't it? It was like,
to
go through my dad's records and find this one. I was like,
I mean, I would have always thought I knew everything about them. And then you start your own proper personal discovery of them as a teenager. And then you start finding things that you didn't even know that they'd written. Like, you might have sang Octopus's Garden and Maxwell's Silver Hammer and All Together Now at school assembly. And, like, they did that one as well. Like, all of those children's songs.
Yeah.
And I don't think I knew they did Let It Be. I'd heard that somewhere else. And, you know.
I think because I'm a little bit younger than you two, and for my generation, I found a few people that got into the White Album quite a lot later than all the others because it was so prohibitively expensive. When it got released on CD, because it always used to be about 40 quid.
I got it on cassette at a, you know, a low point in cassette prices. So I might have got it for about 8 quid or something. But
yeah, so that for me was a bit of a pain in the ass. But then I got to rediscover it in my sort of, probably only really listened to it properly when I was like 18, 19 years old. So have you had many records that you've then reassessed in that way? What was, like, the last, I mean, most recent Beatles record that you got into that, like, passed you by?
None of them really passed me by, because as a teenager, I sort of followed them through chronologically again, which I did with a lot of older bands that I got into. I'd buy them one by one in the order they came out. So when I was maybe 13 or 14, I think I went out and bought Please Please Me for myself. I've gotten into all these re-releases they've done over the last few years, the updated stereo versions and stuff.
Yeah.
We were in Abbey Road recording with Liam for the first album. And I came out of the room to go to the toilet and I bumped into two producers who I'd worked with on something else. And they just said, "Oh, Christian, just follow us for a minute." And I was like, "Oh, why?" And they said, just honestly, just follow us." We went into this room and they were listening to the Dolby Atmos mix of Sgt. Pepper for the, like, it was the world premiere of it. Nobody had heard it before. Amazing. So there were 64 speakers around the walls and we just listened to this new version of it.
Christ. And were you straight back to your bedroom, age 13?
it was amazing the way it pulled out, because they'd managed to get hold of the all the original four tracks that they'd bounced down from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So was this the Giles Martin kind of?
Yeah. They managed to sort of separate things out like never before, hadn't they?
There's loads of stuff that sounds like it's been added.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Stereo mixers were such an afterthought because mono was everything, and like the YTS lad got left to do a stereo mix quick because there was like this new novelty format out.
So yeah, the Beatles kind of signed off on things in mono, and then this guy would just pan all the drums left and put the vocals right and everything, and that's the stereo versions we know, right? You know, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Which, if you had a Ford Escort with only one set of speakers working, meant that you got a pretty weird version of Revolver on cassette.
Yeah.
In a pub I worked in, I used to put music on and they had the left speaker in one room and the right speaker in the other. So, like, you just hear Paul McCartney's voice and a tambourine or something. And
And there was also, like, loads of vary speed in instructions seem to have gotten lost. Like, so, She's Leaving Home was a semitone down on the stereo version.
Oh, right. Yeah, so there was... I remember listening to a Giles Martin interview where he said they did have to do some kind of digital kind of speeding up and stuff to kind of mimic the very speeding stuff.
And I mean, all of those projects, though, they've been brilliant and they've been sensitively done. It's not like someone's gone gung-ho on it.
No.
Definitely...
Yeah, they sort of take just enough liberties to get away with it and stay true to it. Which
They're informed liberties, aren't they, though? It's like,
yeah, exactly.
I think this is what they meant.
Yeah.
some people would argue against. Yeah. That Abbey Road one that's just come out, Scott. Well, I don't know if it's just come out.
Yeah, last year, I think, for the 50th, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's got some real stuff on it.
I mean, one thing I wanted to ask you about that actually specifically was, have you heard the version that they did at Trident of I Want You with Billy Preston, where someone comes down and tells them to shut up because like 2 in the morning, and then they're going, he's like, right, we'll play one more, and it just goes off at the end into this, like, they play the sort of, you know, really heavy end bit with Billy Preston on the Hammond organs, which then just goes around and around. It's like the most incredible key playing, and it's just, it goes, I think it's better than the version that's actually on the record, which is probably sacrilege to say. But as a keyboard player who was into the Beatles, when Billy Preston sort of turns up on that journey, is that something that you like leapt out of you? It was like, right, okay.
Yeah, he really is an unbelievable player, and it's like nothing that anybody who was playing keyboards in this country would have even understood at that time, because... you know, they just wouldn't have heard gospel players like that. And he was really sensitive on the Beatles stuff. He doesn't over egg it, really, but like...
Yeah. I think they encouraged him to sort of come out more and more on those Let It Be sessions.
Yeah. That on the Let It Be Naked sessions, there's a really nice version of The Long and Winding Road, because McCartney always hated Phil Spector's strings on it, didn't he? And there's a bit where Billy Preston just does this really cute little Rhodes solo, which a child could probably play, but it's beautiful, you know. Younger and I found out who Billy Preston was through all that, I started finding bits of his vinyl albums and Greasy Soul and Greasy Soul and You know, Billy's Bag, have you ever heard that?
No, I didn't know that.
No, I don't think so. I'll check it out.
It's cool.
Yeah. I love his version. He did it in the George Harrison tribute concert at Royal Albert Hall. Just
My Sweet Lord.
And he
that.
Plays that version of My Sweet Lord, which is just nuts.
Yeah. That's amazing.
So when you were at Obey Road, did you get to play any of the like hallowed instruments that are still there? I know that the piano
is
still
I've recorded there twice. And the piano that I was on in the room, I was thinking, this must be it. This must be it. And it's got to be what they've used on. Anyway, I found out later, I think John had used it on A Day in the Life. So they're not precious about any of the kit that's in there. It's all just, it's functional still, you know. It's not like it's museum pieces.
Does it make you play differently knowing that?
I found that out afterwards.
Oh, right,
The first time I went in fact, both times I've been in, I think I've been in Studio 2. So the big famous one is... Oh, no, it's two.
Two's the one they did most of their stuff in, yeah.
That's Sgt. Pepper and all that. That's the massive one.
Yeah.
So I've been in three and I was like, so they didn't do anything.
So close for no cigar.
And then the guy said, well, no, the big one, the famous one's two. They did Sgt. Pepper in there. I was like, oh, well. And he said, they did do Revolver in here. I was like, all right, well, that's something. Yeah. It's hardly nothing, is it, the Revolver room?
Yeah, I think the Mellotron's still there as well, the Strawberry Fields Mellotron.
I didn't get a go on that. The Hammond's an RT3, and I think they've always had that, so I imagine that's the one that's been used on. That's quite a rare Hammond for people to use as a RT3. It's like it's bigger than a B3 or a C3. Yeah. It's got a full church pedal board, which most of them don't have. So,
what's your kind of setup for playing live with Liam Gallagher?
I've been making it bigger and bigger all the time. It's gone out of control now. It's good. I've got one of those digital Mellotrons.
Oh yeah, the Mellotron.
No, it's actually Mellotron, but it's a Swedish guy who I think bought the name.
Right.
But he actually makes full Mellotrons.
Cool.
He makes a 5,000 quid analog one with tape in it.
Wow.
Well, and then he also does a digital one.
We did a gig with Jan at a festival where the Kooks were playing on the main stage.
They're on everywhere.
Yeah.
I thought they were done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you go to festivals abroad and it's like you're playing with the Stones. It's like, oh, the Kooks are on.
Really? Did you say they were done?
Yeah, I thought they were done.
Yeah, they are. I don't think they were done. But they had a Mellotron on stage at a festival, which just seemed quite insanely...
No, it's that decadent rock and roll star stuff that only the Kooks abroad can play.
Yeah, the Kooks abroad. I don't know. I don't want to slag off other people's bands. But it seemed a little bit excessive.
It's the Kooks, though. We're on about the Kooks.
Yeah, I think that's all right.
Yeah.
Fine.
I don't listen.
No.
Liam stuff, how's the Beatles kind of making their influence felt with that? Are you involved in any of the songwriting elements of that? Or?
No. I get to do some of the recordings with him, but I mean, he's obviously a Beatles fan. It's well documented,
but
he's more of a John Lennon fan than anything.
Yeah.
You know? And he's like, he really knows his solo Lennon stuff inside out. If you turned up, you know, and played him something that sounded like Love Me Do for his next album, you know. And if anybody tries to turn up with anything too obvious, I think he just thinks it's ridiculous.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. But he's definitely, his vocal quality is quite similar to Lennon.
Yeah, so. And when you're, I mean, he's like, if you get in a studio with him, I mean, he's a brilliant singer live in that, you know, he comes out with an attitude that people love, but when you get him in the studio and he sings a little bit quieter,
right,
it increases his range and just the quality of it as an instrument. And
yeah,
the first time I was in the room when he started singing in the studio, you know, I it was just that rare moment where you realize you're just with a really world-class singer.
Wow.
And you know, the quality of it was almost like John Lennon was in the room or something. Wow. Not exactly the same, but...
Yeah, it's a bit more powerful and guttural.
Yeah, like I remember watching Nebworth after a few cans
a while ago. I've just watched the whole Nebworth gig. And his vocal on it is like there are bits of it where he sounds like Kurt Cobain, you know, it's like properly kind of screaming at certain points. And he does have that real power, like because it's kind of that punk quality as well, you know.
He's one of those people, his voice is actually really loud as well. It's got such a resonant, sonorous quality about it that you're just sort of like, if you're having a drink and you start arguing about something, it's like you're having a bad dream. you know when you can't cry out in a dream, you're like, bleh, bleh, and he's going like, ah, you know. It's just such a thick, high-quality voice.
Wow.
Yeah.
Compared to my pathetic little...
timbre.
Block nose.
I always remember his cover when Oasis used to regularly cover Eye on the Walrus.
Oh, yeah.
And that was like kind of what we were talking about. Like, right, it's like John Lennon, but it's like John Lennon times, you know, without the double tracking times 10 sort of thing. It really belts out.
Doesn't matter if it's out of tune.
Yeah. he's amazing in the studio. It's like, people always think now, see all these forum conversations about what kind of technical trickery is going on, but it's like he actually just is good.
Mm. Yeah, naturally good.
I know he's had bad points in the past where it's gone a bit more, and probably he's been drinking and smoking more. Just like 90% of singers, the voice. I've met a few over the years who seem to be able to just smoke and drink and have no effect whatsoever on them, but most of them, you know. If they only get 2 hours sleep, they lose half the range, don't they?
It feels like he's taking it a little bit more seriously, like in the last couple of years. Like, as he's
definitely does. He really does, and it's like
that MTV Unplugged thing. Because in my quote unquote real job, I worked a bit on that. Did you play on that up in Hull?
Yeah.
And his voice in that is like pretty stunning.
Yeah, so it was a great gig. I mean, the end product is. I mean, I think for everybody who was there, it was a really amazing occasion, but I don't think they would have heard it like it's turned out as an album, because on the night you could just hear the crowd.
Right.
Just singing along with everything so loud.
And that's a number one record then, right?
Yeah, this week,
That's brilliant. Congratulations.
Yeah,
amazing. Well, it's the first... I mean, I've been on all three of his number one records now, but this is the first one where I feel like it's a... genuine involvement, because it was a gig we all did.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
It was great.
Do you have a controversial Beatles opinion, like an album that you actually don't rate or a song that you think is not very good?
I think that people who go around saying Revolver's the best album are twats.
Really? Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think that Revolver's not the best album.
Right.
I just think that people who say that are twats.
Is there anything you don't like about Revolver then? Or is it just like, do you think
love Revolver. Right. I think it might be the best album. But
you just self-twatted.
I mean, I hate people who go around saying that, like, this is the one to listen to.
Right, because you think Beatles. It's kind of like a music-y, a kind of snobby thing where it's like...
Yeah,
it's a fucking, you know, it's a sort of like... Q writers sort of like top 50 albums you must hear, and you know, at number two is probably something by KLF, and they've got Revolver at one, but they didn't put the White Album in,
right?
Just to show you, like, there, what do you think about that? I didn't even fucking bother with the White Album. So I've only put one Beatles album in, or it'll be at number six and they'll have the New York Dolls at one,
right?
Just like, you know, just fuck off. You would seriously just put Beatles albums in the top 10.
Didn't Daniel Johnston ask to list his favourite albums, and they're all 10 of them were Beatles albums?
I can believe that, yeah. He was devastated when he found out he didn't sound like them.
Yeah. Actually, but this I didn't mean to do this, but you did play with Daniel Johnston, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Just well, I played with him over the course of a weekend, so I did a Thursday night session with him.
So this was with the earlies, right?
Yeah. We all turned up. Well, all the English earlies turned up for it, and then on the Friday we did a gig with him in Manchester, and then on the Sunday we did a festival in somewhere. What is there in sort of near Oxford?
Truck Wilderness.
No, Wilderness. Is that one?
That's near Oxford. Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So 3 days, three playing occasions, and he definitely didn't recognise me from one day to the next.
And were you were learning his songs, though, and kind of...
Yeah, did a full set of them. Wow. I can't remember what was in it, really. Yeah. But they sort of send you an email before you play with him saying, these are the songs that bands tend to play with him. Mm. Could do any of these, and...
But I guess you wouldn't have rehearsed
the ones that he liked. Right. You don't know.
You don't rehearse in that sense.
So we spent, like, an hour all together in the Six Music studio, sort of rehearsing a couple of his tunes up.
Wow.
And Speeding Motorcycle was going to be the first one.
Yeah.
And we got together an intro for it, for him to then come in afterwards. And he walked into the room at 7:01 before we went on air. And we just said to him what we were going to do. And he's like, all right. And then halfway through the counting, he just started singing and... We all just had to join in around him. And yeah, I found it on YouTube the other day. It's a really shambolic start.
Yeah. Well,
that's it sort of suits the job.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. So what do you mean when you said that he was upset when he didn't sound like the Beatles? Like, you mean discovering his sound or like when he's actually...
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I think he always assumed that he would because he was so into them.
And it's quite a high bar to set yourself though, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, it never works for anybody to try and sound too like them, does it? I mean, people always reckon that Oasis sound like them, but, you know, Oasis borrow things from them, but they sound nothing like them.
Yeah.
Oasis sound more like Slade than...
Yeah, Slade is definitely a thing. But some of Noel Gallagher's melodies have got that Lennon thing where it's staying on kind of one note kind of thing.
It's the chords as well, isn't it? Like, you can go into a major three chord or a minor four, or there's just lots of little... Mm. Beatles tricks in there.
I remember when I was learning Beatles songs, you know, I had the Beatles for Acoustic Guitar book, and whenever it was a Lennon song, it was like my first introduction to, I guess, like non-regular time and stuff. I noticed that because Lennon's always kind of dropping a bar of 2/4 in, or there's lots of kind of unusual things like that, and also going to unusual minors where you wouldn't expect it and things. And that, so it's like the first introduction to music and thinking about music and playing music, where it was like you were going outside of kind of what you knew, I think, from having just learnt bar chords or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I think he was such an instinctive rule breaker.
Yeah.
That a lot of those, like a lot of his melodies are, because then the range is relatively limited, but he sort of, his rhythms are kind of rhythms of speech.
Yeah, definitely. Whereas,
like, Paul McCartney will write words to fit a melody.
Yeah.
Paul, he is more of a kind of stream of consciousness.
Totally. Like, I mean, Strawberry Fields is probably one of just my favourite Lennon melodies. I mean, it's such a weird melody, but it sounds very like something you'd hear in a dream. It's almost like this completely instinctive melody, you know.
It's really hard to think about because they've all become such established, everyday British sounds and sounds for musicians that, like, imagine in a world before anybody's heard Strawberry Fields.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to do, but it's like everything about that record's just, I don't believe in God for a second, but I think he had something to do with Strawberry Fields.
Yeah.
Like, to think that they could record two versions
at
slightly different tempos in different keys and then just fit them together. Oh, that works.
And as soon as you hear that fact, it just sticks out like a sore thumb, I think, now. Like, as soon as I heard that, it's like Lennon's voice sounds so slowed down in the second half, doesn't it? It's really noticeably slowed down.
That's that period where they were just like, you know, I think you've just wanted them to record 24 hours a day because there was so much magic happening, seemingly without much effort, because they were just on such a roll. And I think that's probably where another kind of Oasis comparison comes in, because that sort of period, I don't think there was another, certainly British songwriter, who wrote that quality for such a sustained amount of time as Noel Gallagher did in those like 3 years of those early Oasis tunes. For them, it probably didn't last. But one thing we were talking about the other day was, if you could, if you had the power to go back in time and keep the Beatles going for another 10 years, would you have rather, or would you rather have them just like called it a day and quit in 1970?
I think it's good. It's good that it stopped where it did, because there's no more perfect an end to a career than Abbey Road.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
And finishing a record like that with the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, and which is a perfect last statement for any band. And then, just in case it got a bit too serious, put in Her Majesty just after it. That's perfect. That's the perfect end to a career.
Yeah.
And then if you keep the Beatles going, you probably never get All Things Must Pass.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
Which is the best post-Beatles solo career album. I love all the solo stuff. And I don't think... I think if they'd have kept going, they just would never have had that mythical status.
Mm. Yeah.
They'd have just been one of those fixtures that's around forever, like that. It would have took one of them to die for anybody to care about
them. Yeah. We were talking last week about the idea that if they were in the 80s, and can you imagine a Beatles kind of with 80s production and 80s and chorus guitars or something?
Yeah.
It's all those bands that didn't break up just end up just making a few where you just wish they hadn't.
Yeah.
It's hard enough to listen to those Free as a Bird ones.
I like Free as a Bird, actually.
I love them, but I just hate the way that they sound. I don't know why...
They needed
to make them sound like Yellow, exactly. They just sound too... I would have preferred them to do it in like a kind of retro-y way.
But I can remember waiting for that to come on the night it was released and thinking, oh, I hope... Because I don't know if I was expecting it to sound like McCartney's Flowers in the Dirt album or something like that.
You know,
figure of eight. Just some rocking good time tunes. Well, like
we had that in the on cassette in the car, Flowers in the Dirt.
It's fine, but I just didn't want the Beatles to come back sounding like that.
There's a great bit in the anthology Extras where they're recording Free as a Bird, and you can see like Paul is so excited that him and Ringo are just like absolutely over the moon, talking about like it's like a Beatles record, it's like it's here. And it cuts to George and it goes, well, of course, it's going to sound like them if it is them. So nonplussed by the whole thing, which probably summed up the attitude. I think All Things Must Pass, you could see them working that maybe into like a Beatles record, but it definitely is better that it was on its own. But it's sort of Living in Material World is my favourite solo album, actually.
I end up leaning to the Wings ones a lot. I have to be careful, though. That's not a cool answer. I love Band on the Run. I love Venus and Mars.
I was going to say, I remember having a conversation with you about, like, what's your... Because I think we did a tour when we were playing in the Revival Hour about what was your favourite Christmas song. And I think we all agreed we liked the Paul McCartney Christmas song. Simply Having
Wonderful
a
Christmas Time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Because CS80...
Yeah,
well, we're not nerding out on gear, but
it's got a and you pointed out that the delay isn't in time, which I can always hear.
Have I ruined it for you?
Yeah, no, it's fine. But like, because I think the goal was to not try and be cool and not say like the low Christmas album or something, but like, what's a good Christmas song you like? And I think that was one we were in agreement on, which I actually quite liked. It's such a weird first line, isn't it? The moon is right.
Yeah, can't argue with that, Paul.
Yeah.
And somebody who's written so many lyrics, they know that they're not going to be made or broken by it.
Fine.
The moon's right.
The moon's right.
But those Wings records, it's interesting because I saw him at the O2 at Christmas time, which I kind of was really nervous about because every time I see him, I'm like, right, he's so good. That is the last time I'm going to see him because he's only going to sort of get worse. And he was absolutely belting a few months ago, but he played a lot of Wings stuff. And I think a lot of that does deserve a bit of reassessment. And a lot of 80s stuff as well. That I think when John Lennon died, there was kind of a backlash against Paul almost for just the fact that he survived and that you know, his 80s stuff gets really kind of maligned.
Mm. Yeah, you watch the outpouring the day that Paul McCartney dies. Yeah. It's like...
exactly.
I know everyone sort of knows he's a genius now, but he's sort of damned for his enthusiasm.
Yeah.
He's like, he's so shamelessly happy to be a Beatle.
Yeah.
And he loves music so much, and he's happy to turn up and tell anecdotes and do a song. You know, you wouldn't have got John Lennon going around Liverpool with James Corden.
No.
You know, it's like... McCartney will, he'll be McCartney all day long for people.
I do worry about what John Lennon would be like now, you know, because I follow Sean Lennon on like Instagram and stuff, and Sean Lennon almost gets a little bit conspiracy theory, libertarian style, a little bit Jordan Peterson-y. I kind of wonder if John Lennon would have gone full blown kind of red pill kind of. You know,
he could have done, but it's like it seemed like he was in a very good place when he died. Like he'd grown into the person he was gonna be just before he got taken out. You know, people like artsy mystery from people so much, people to be cool and standoffish, and they struggle to deal with the fact that McCartney has got like a spaniel's enthusiasm for music. It's like, you know, there's people who can play that game. Like somebody like Prince just understood like how to be a sort of complete bell end with the press and and fans and everything, you know. Yeah. And the more I read about Prince, I just think he just understood it and he was having a laugh.
Even when
he was going on about chemtrails and stuff like that.
But that's weird though, isn't it? What happens to, so like Kate Bush, you know, she didn't play live for ages. So when she announced gigs, it was a huge event. Whereas like Robert Plant has just almost quietly been carrying on making new music and gigging regularly. And it's like less than
the fuss isn't there.
Yeah, there's no kind of fuss in it around it. It's kind of weird how it becomes a... that story takes over. Oh, they're so mysterious. But, you know, she just...
Yeah.
And when John and Lennon started making records that were not up to scratch, he just kind of stopped. Whereas Paul, you know, he was so prolific.
Through it.
And, you know, you get his 80s period. We're looking back on it now, it's actually like, well, you know, he never sort of stood still and went back to making like a, you know, full rock and roll album produced by Phil Spector or whatever. He made Temporary Secretary.
Yeah. Temporary Secretary.
The problem is for these guys as well is, you know, whether it's McCartney or Brian Wilson or, you know, they don't get compared. Like you can take a week that a new McCartney album comes out and it'll get 3 stars in The Observer or something next to something that's obviously shitter.
Yeah.
That's getting 4 or 5. But McCartney's not being judged against the other records out that week. He's being judged against, you know,
Eleanor Rigby.
Eleanor Rigby, or, whatever.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Have you met Paul, Christian?
No. No, I haven't. Charlie, who does all the filming for Liam, invited me to one of those gigs on that last tour that you must have gone to.
Mm.
And I was in the middle of a rehearsal with Liam and the gig was in Liverpool. And Charlie's like, you should come up to this, put you on the guest list. And then I said, oh, give it to somebody else. I don't think I'll make it. And then the rehearsal finished 2 minutes after I gave it up and I could have easily made it.
Oh, no.
But I have seen him once in Manchester and it was absolutely amazing.
Oh, cool.
But I don't think there's any use in me meeting any Beatles. I don't think I've got any, you know. I can't tell them that I'm more of a fan than anybody else they've talked to.
In a way, it's my worst nightmare. If I was actually confronted with one of them.
But it's like whatever way you think you're gonna play it, they've had it done to them.
Yeah,
you know, if you're gonna say act like you'd never heard of the Beatles, they've seen that done. And if you're gonna act like you're the biggest fan of all time, they've seen that done.
Yeah.
Or if you go up and tell them that you loved Wilson Pickett's version of Hey Jude, that's been done.
Yeah.
So
there's nothing you got to pull on them.
And it's very unlikely that Paul's going to be like, oh, you seem pretty cool. Do you want to come back to my house and I'll show you how I wrote Hey Jude?
I mean, I see this. I see this with Liam and like people get in touch with me online and stuff and just like, I just want to meet him. Can you sort it out? And it's like, it's not going to, I mean, I don't say this to them. I should, but it's, you know, he's not going to just hear that you like, you know, Parkers and Man City and invite you on holiday with him.
It's like,
my question is, did the Beatles exist? Which is kind of question where we're talking about, I sometimes think that the Beatles were too good and that it was probably...
Did you ever read Dirk Gently?
Yeah, I love Dirk Gently, yeah.
And at the end, did they go to another world where there's melodies floating in the air and then they come back?
Yeah.
And somebody's playing a Bach cello suite.
That's right, yeah.
What's that? And it turns out they just snuck them into history. Obviously no person could have composed all that.
Just thought
we'd stick it in.
But that's the kind of thing I'm going for. It's like they were so good and the progression was so incredible.
This is a Matrix style plot.
It
does seem almost impossible. And it's like when you first get in a band and you think, oh, we'll be really creative, and everything that you could possibly come up with, like, oh, we'll try some different instruments, or we'll turn some stuff backwards, or we'll open a book and just pull random words from it. Any creative thing you think you've got, they've done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like there's no corners left to root around in. they've done very well at managing the legacy as well. It's like they don't turn up on shitty sort of best of the 60s compilations. And then like somebody like Hendrix, I always think he's had like such a money hungry estate.
Yeah.
Anytime he went anywhere near a tape recorder, that's been put out on a CD of some sort. And so there's lots of meaningless Hendrix jams.
There is a lot of like, that's a really interesting point about legacy, isn't it? Because like, say the Kinks. I mean, like, you know, obviously you love the Kinks, but I think Dave Davis, right? I follow him on Instagram. I love Dave Davis. But it's just, I sort of wish he wasn't on Instagram, because sometimes it's just like a really blurry photo of him going like, you know, I'm going for a foul today or something like that. You know,
he likes curry as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another band that then went on to record all through the 80s and stuff and then, you know, and go downhill in a very documented fashion.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the album covers were just like so bad for the Kinks.
Kinks, yeah.
That one is it about the naughty school children or something? The cover is
kind of it was difficult for the Kinks because they sort of got robbed of their prime.
Yeah,
because of the sort of musicians' union disputes in America. So then they only really got to cash in the 80s.
Yeah. That's true.
By doing the stadium tours over there. And
there's also, like, it's just really interesting reading. So do you know the 33 and a third book series?
Yeah, I haven't read any of them, but
they're quite good. The one about Village Green preservation is written by Andy Miller, who presents the Backlisted podcast, which is really good. But he just makes a really good point that Village Green kind of is, you know, didn't make it much of a dent because it was just really badly marketed. Like, they changed the track listing around, and like by the time it came out, you know, Sergeant Pepper had happened, so people didn't really want this kind of like suburban observation, like Little England kind of thing. They were thinking more globally, so it's just weird how, I mean, that's such a great album, but it just didn't have that epoch defining thing because, you know, someone,
there's a lot of things that we now reassess in terms of the Beatles' careers' place in history, so it's like. It's really hard to understand how Odyssey and Oracle by the Zombies, you know, isn't in the same kind of status league as Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, I love that album.
You know, I absolutely love that album. And it's a real sort of high point of 60s psychedelia. And there's not many bands were writing with a sense of harmony that Rod Argent had.
Mm. Was he the pianist, the keyboard
player? Yeah. He went on to be in Argent.
But yeah, some of the chords are so interesting. Like, I love Hung Up on Dream on that album, which is kind of weird.
The Beach Boys are the obvious parallel, aren't they?
Yeah.
But there's something so English about them, kind of.
Yeah.
But any sort of documentary about music in the 60s would kind of have you believe that the only people writing records were the Beatles and the Beach Boys. A little bit of that. There's a, you know, I feel very sorry for the Kinks and lots of other bands of that period. And also there's a sort of overlap that you get in the kind of music that was being made in 60, especially 68, 69, they're so in the shadow of the breakup of the Beatles and stuff. Mm. It's weird to think that like Led Zeppelin 1 predates like Abbey Road and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't even think about that.
That
is weird. Yeah. There you go. Mm. Take them to school.
If you could play for an hour with one Beatle in their prime in the studio, which one would you choose?
I reckon George. Mm. I've never thought of that before, though. Yeah. But then he had Billy Preston, so he would have just been like, where's my regular keyboard player? So, I mean, and then you could say John, but then John had a real range of people, didn't he? Yeah.
Who's the guy who plays keys on Imagine?
Well, that's Nicky Hopkins does most of it.
He's got some lovely stuff in, like Oh My Love and stuff, where he plays that.
Yeah, and he does the Jealous Guy intro. He plays on a lot of Kink stuff as well, Nicky Hopkins.
Oh, right, cool.
Made a lot of those records. He plays the solo on Revolution. Played on a lot of Stone stuff. He's a great player. Mm. Yeah, they were mucked up with good opportunities. I don't, like... It's hard to know where you'd be useful to them, really. Maybe out of all of them, I'd be the most used to John in a studio situation, but that's sort of like assuming that Nicky Hopkins has broken his hand or something like that.
Yeah.
Very hard to insert yourself in history, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's so great about that stuff, maybe I know it better because it's documented so well in that documentary, but because John Lennon always plays quite low down in the register.
Yeah.
There's so much space up top for to noodle around.
I saw that one. Was it on last year?
The Imagine, what's the name of it? But the one where, he's writing, like, How Do You Sleep? And
he was doing Imagine, and Nicky Hopkins was doing this quite flowery part over the top of it.
Which said, I actually think sounded better, actually, personally.
Well, it's a quite well-established record now, Imagine, isn't it? So
yeah.
Sounded a bit weird.
So all of you, and you've got a lot of gigs that have been cancelled with Liam, but are they going to be rescheduled? Are you going to be back on tour at the end of the year next year?
So. I mean, I think all the British festivals, they seem to be moving to next year. Mm. But then we had stuff like, we had a tour of South America and an Asian tour, and I don't know if they're, going to get rescheduled or what. Here's hoping. But we're probably,
And you've been releasing your own music as well. You've got an album on Bandcamp.
I've done two.
Yeah.
Released to a deafening silence.
But yeah, tell us about them. We'll plug them.
I just sort of in the middle of I did my first one before I joined Liam's band, and then I thought I'll try having a solo career doing organ instrumentals of this, you know, Billy Preston, Booker T kind of style that I've always liked. Yeah. But I did one, and then I got this job and it took my life up, really.
Yeah.
But then sort of in between tours, I wrote another one, and I've just released it in the middle of this lockdown, and I would like to gig that stuff someday. I think I'm going to put it out on vinyl as well, actually.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Which again,
nice.
I'm going to limit the amount of those I press up.
Yeah.
There's only so many beds we could get them under. Them. They don't sell, but, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
And will that be available on...
I put everything out on Bandcamp.
Yeah.
Great. Mark Riley played it last night, actually.
Oh, great.
So cool. That was good. Nice. That felt pretty mainstream.
Amazing. So what's the album called?
Understand the Rules.
Lovely.
I like titles that sound like they're shouting at you. You know?
Cool. Well, thank you so much for doing this, Christian. It's been wicked to talk to you.
Thank you.
Very insightful. And enjoy the rest of your summer.
I could have gone on, you know.
So that was Christian Madden there talking about his own personal Beatles. It was a lovely episode. Lots of lovely reminiscences. I think playing John Lennon and Mark David Chapman in the playground is
Very unusual story. It did make me laugh, but somewhat macabre. But yeah, that was great. It was really good. I love how I love this with all the guests we talk to. You know, we start off talking to them, and there's this point where they start to get a bit misty-eyed when they're talking about definitely. Beatles, and that's it's a lovely moment to capture that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's so evocative, isn't it? And you know, he was so great to talk to. And if you want to hear any of his music, the stuff that he records under his own name is available on Spotify and various other platforms, and really worth checking out.
Yeah, we should also plug his Bandcamp page, because he's releasing a lot of stuff on Bandcamp, and he's recorded stuff in lockdown, hasn't he? So his Bandcamp page is christianmadden.bandcamp.com. And his latest album is Understand the Rules, which is really, really good.
Well, that was really enjoyable. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed it as much as we did, you can go to Apple Podcasts or Acast and leave us a nice 5-star review. It really does help new listeners find the show. So it's, you know, very important. So we're sorry to harp on about it, but we're going to. We'll be back next week with another fantastic episode. So see you next Tuesday.
Cheerio.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.